I'm delighted now to welcome Jason Lewis. He is author of the trilogy, The Expedition, the true story of the first human-powered circumnavigation of the Earth. And he will be talking about this whole adventure and signing copies of the first part of this trilogy called Dark Waters this Saturday, November 17th at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So I have to ask, how in the world did you get the idea to circumnavigate the Earth? That means both land and water, not with sailboats, but with actually human-powered vehicles of one kind or another.
Yeah, people had, this was back in 1992, all those years ago, people had bicycled across continents, and a few people had even rode across oceans. At that point, but interestingly enough, no one had put a continuous journey together to keep on going west or east and do a complete circumnavigation using just the power of the human body. So actually my ex-university friend Steve Smith came up with this idea and pitched me, and it just sounded like such an incredible adventure in terms of the scope and the scale and the fact that it didn't the means to do so had been around for centuries, just using the human body, and it didn't involve fossil fuels. That it sounded to me like just one of those adventures that there just had to be done.
So you basically had a boat built, tried very hard to get sponsorship, which turned out to be very elusive, and basically turned this whole thing into a pedal-powered boat using kind of bicycle technology. And doing it just, I don't know how you did it. I mean, by hook or by crook, with sort of loans and pennies and no corporate sponsorship, at least at the beginning, whatsoever.
Right. It was a long, we always knew it would take a while. I mean, we thought maybe 3 to 4 years. And no company really wanted to invest that into that amount of time. I guess people, marketing managers like short events over maybe a few weeks or months where they can see their return pretty quickly in terms of media coverage. So we ultimately had to borrow some money off friends and family to get going, and our idea was that if we could pedal across the Atlantic, which was our first major crossing, 5,000 miles from Portugal to Miami, then we would prove ourselves as adventurers, as a known quantity, and then perhaps we would find sponsorship in the U.S. So that was our plan, and so I remember going to my bank before leaving London and drawing out my entire savings, which amounted to £319.20, which is about $450, and that was my entire sort of kitty to start off around the world with.
And now, was the first leg of the trip the ocean part?
We left London from the Greenwich Meridian line, and we cycled down through France, Spain, and Portugal with the idea that the way the currents work in the North Atlantic, we'd have a better chance of reaching Miami if we put the boat in the water off the Portuguese coast. So we were, in a sense, using the same winds and currents, although we weren't using a sail, that, for example, the early explorers like Columbus used to get across to the New World.
Were either of you seafaring people before that?
Not at all. We had probably about two or three days' worth of sea experience between us. So we were very inexperienced. We'd done some bike riding before. Like you mentioned before, getting across land was going to be no problem. We could walk. We could bicycle, we could inline skate, getting across between islands, we could kayak, we could swim the rivers perhaps, like in Southeast Asia or wherever. But the big ocean crossings were really the big unknown. So that was why we had this 26-foot by 4-foot boat built that was big enough to carry enough food and water for two people to survive up to 150 days at sea without resupply, but was narrow enough and was streamlined enough that it would move easily through the water. So we figured, we do a yacht master's course before we leave London, and we know we can pedal. So what else can go wrong, you know, crossing the Atlantic, you know, in this kind of wonderful boat that had been built to withstand storms and big weather and that kind of thing?
What else can go wrong indeed? I mean, one of the things that is so fascinating about this book to me is that at least half of the problem or more is mental rather than physical, and that is not to underplay the physical trials of a trip like that, but the deep boredom and monotony and challenge of being with just one other person on the open sea for so long was, I guess, something that you couldn't even possibly have imagined before you set out.
Right. That's very well put. You can't anticipate how you're going to react or how you're going to be able to deal with this enormous amount of space where nothing changes really from day to day. I mean, apart from the audit, we had probably two or three storms on the whole crossing, 111-day crossing. And they were the most exciting events, really, when things get interesting. But for the most part, for 95% of the time, you know, it's just blue. As far as the eye can see, you don't see reds or yellows. The sounds are the same. So in terms of sensory information, it becomes very samey. And we found that, you know, if you just think about the other side, pedaling to the other side of this enormous stretch of water, it's too far away, and it's difficult to motivate yourself towards something that's so far in the future. So we really, the key we found was to partly to break not only the voyage but also each day up into little psychological carrots that we could pedal towards in the form of a cup of tea and a Mars bar break in a 2 hours time, or you know, maybe a meal, like we're going to look forward to our meal in 6 hours time, but almost break it down even more, so that the more that you can immerse yourself in the present, the better, the easier it is to deal with, and in a way, the better you perform, and ultimately the faster you go. So it's a paradox, you know, like the quickest way to pedal across the Atlantic is actually to forget about the other side and just try and think about the here and now.
I was reading this book yesterday, and then I went to sleep, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and I had one of those dark nights of the soul, only I started thinking about the book. And I was in my warm bed in my safe house surrounded by three little nice doggies. And I thought, what if I were on the Atlantic Ocean surrounded by a completely indifferent sea that had creatures in it and storms and things like that? And I got physically scared. And did you experience that kind of existential fear when you were there?
Okay, so I have to admit that, you know, my pedaling partner, he didn't really enjoy being at sea, which is ironic because he thought of this idea in the first place. And I found that I actually really enjoyed being out there in that empty space, and which sort of harks back to what you were saying earlier in terms of it's hard to know how you're going to react to this very, very alien environment. But there was one thing that I terrified of, and that is giant squid. And I guess it comes from having read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Jules Verne, when I was a boy. And I just would lie, because this boat that we were in had a narrow sleeping compartment in the front, just almost like a coffin, you know. But you could lie out flat, and that was the only place on the boat that you could really get any real rest when your body wasn't constantly moving. And so one night we were two-thirds of the way across the Atlantic, and I woke. Steve was pedaling at the time on his nighttime shift, and I woke to the sound of this heavy pounding underneath the boat, and I had no idea what it was. And I was, and this fear came to me that it was this giant squid, this kraken that was gonna like clamber on the boat, and it was gonna. We were going to have these big arms like snaking into the cockpit and pulling us out in the water. And so I looked at Steve. I said, wow, you know, stick your head out and see what it is. And he said, no way, man, I'm not going to stick my head out. So stick your head out and see what it is. And at that point, he closed the hatch, which is so that there's a big sliding hatch. And he closed that just in time before the boat was actually flipped over by whatever it was onto its side. And then there was just silence, nothing. And we were waiting for this thing, whatever it was, to come back. And it never did come back. And so the conclusion that we had was that it was a whale, perhaps, that was either inquisitive or had a like an itchy back. But that was perhaps my most frightening kind of moments on the Atlantic was when we had this mystery visitor to us at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Amazing. Now, you took turns pedaling so that there was never really a moment where there wasn't somebody actually pedaling the boat and looking out for basically other boats, because if you were to have run into a freighter or some gigantic ocean liner of some kind, not only would you be a goner, but they wouldn't even notice that they'd hit you.
Exactly. And we actually had a friend, Peter Bird, who was lost at sea on the Pacific. He was a rower. He was rowing across the North Pacific and was actually lost at sea in 1996. For that very reason, he was solo, and I guess they found his boat, but they didn't find him. And he had obviously been sleeping, and this ship or whatever had just run him over, and he'd got wound up in the propellers, and that was it. So that was why we, having the luxury of two people on board, always had someone awake pedaling for 2 hour shifts in the day and 4 hour shifts at night, and that way we always had a pair of eyeballs trained on the horizon looking out for other ships.
It also meant that you never ever got like 7 or 8 hours of sleep in a row.
Then that was, I think, the most grueling part of the journey was not the physical part, like you mentioned. It was the mental aspect of, the boredom, but also just the fatigue. I just remember this, never getting enough sleep, never getting more than, probably, parents of small children can relate to this, but never getting more than two or three hours of sleep at a time before you have to get up and pedal again in this case. And after a week of that, it's amazing how you just turn into this zombie, and we called it the creeping gray funk, where this fatigue would just affect everything in your day, and it would actually affect how safely we were able to operate the boat. And this really became, I think, the biggest kind of challenge of the whole crossing was just remaining competent enough to actually, man the boat safely.
One of the things that I found so interesting about what you did and kind of how you handled these long stretches of time was you kind of went into a meditative set of practices, which it doesn't sound like you were really trained in all that much, but you had the time and there you were. And one of the things that you did was you started looking at words and the meanings of words and the emptiness of those meanings of words. Tell us about that process.
So I guess I always knew that I was going to need some way to motivate myself on this voyage. And I thought that by finding a mechanism to immerse myself in the present more would help. So I was not an expert in meditation at all when I started, but I read a book, and while I was pedaling along, I would read a book, and then I would practice some of what I'd learned. And once I got into the managed to grasp the whole business of focusing on the breath, which was the way of meditation that I was looking at, I then started looking at other aspects of my previous life on land that I guess I'd taken for granted, and looking at them objectively. And words were just language, I guess, was one way to sort of look at something which, hey, we use all every day on normal, in our normal lives on land, but we take for granted. And it was just fascinating, like taking words which I previously thought had really concrete, definitive meaning, words like good or bad or evil, or looking, putting those under the microscope, as it were, during meditation, and realizing how these words really had no innate meaning. They were really just associated with, values that we're brought up with, that we're conditioned with, depending on where we're brought up in the world. Even like the idea of being English, I'm an Englishman. Well, what does that mean, And you realize that a lot of who you are is actually a product of where you were brought up in the world, and that's not necessarily any better or worse than an identity, a cultural identity that someone might have from a very different part of the world.
And It's also different from the identity that you have when you're on the ocean, because the values you were brought up with are kind of irrelevant when you're out there, and you really have to kind of have new values.
Correct. And I remember at the end of the voyage looking at my wallet, you know, about to arrive in Miami, and looking, okay, I better get my wallet ready, and seeing all these things in there that you need to navigate your way around normal day life, normal society, things like bank cards and money and identity cards and passports and all these kind of things. And of course, they mean nothing out there on the ocean. And it's, again, it's a fascinating process to sort of remove yourself from all that you'd taken for granted, all that you thought was concrete and real, by immersing yourself into this very, very alien liquid environment, the ocean. And then realizing, well, hang on, who am I really? And for those who are predisposed to maybe finding out a little better about who they are, the wilderness is a great venue to do that, to strip away, rather like an onion, strip away all these layers of who you think you are, and then underneath all of these layers, there is actually somebody different, perhaps somebody who you maybe didn't know very well before.
I've always thought the onion metaphor was kind of odd, because no matter how many layers you strip away, there's just still more onion.
There is, but I would argue that underneath all of these layers of language and identity and all of these, what Richard Dawkins, professor, would call memes, ideas and belief systems and all these values that we kind of get brought up with, there is underneath, I think, just a purer self that isn't necessarily aligned or attached to any kind of cultural bias. And I think that is a really valuable thing for anyone to do, because, hey, in this world, we all need to get along to solve all the problems that we have in the world today. And I think that if you're driven by bias, by cultural bias, then that can actually sort of create more divisions in the world rather than bring us together. So I think I feel privileged to have gone through this dismantling process, if you like, to kind of find out a more universal me, who perhaps I would like to think is maybe a slightly better world citizen than the person who left England all those years ago.
Well, it's so interesting, because there's one part where you're coming to the end of the Atlantic Ocean leg of your journey, and you've been working very hard to kind of explore on the levels that you're talking about right now, and you're thinking, you know, will I ever get to absolute truth? And you write in your diary, absolute truth is just an illusion. And then something very interesting happened. Can you describe that for us?
So this was, I think, day 98 of the voyage. It was towards the end of the voyage, and I've been searching for this truth, for this purity, throughout the whole voyage. And we were nearing to land, and I thought, you know, I realized at that point that I've been trying too hard, and that I wasn't going to find this enlightenment, this epiphany that I was hoping for all that time. So I just forgot about it, and I just let it go. I just thought, you know what, it's not going to happen, And when I let it go, when I wasn't trying anymore, that was when I found myself in the front of the sleeping compartment on this morning, and Steve was pedaling. And ultimately, I had this experience, this what Hindus or Buddhists call samadhi experience, which only lasted for maybe 10 or 15 minutes, where it was like the final layer of illusion, the final onion layer, if you like, fell away. And this sense of non-dualistic awareness came over me. Non-dualism, in other words, normally in life we're always experiencing our reality objectively, right? Where the subject and our surrounding world is objective. But in this short period of insight, that dualism fell away, and there was a real sense of just complete oneness with my surroundings in the boat, but also surroundings in terms of the ocean and the planet and the universe. And it was really an amazing sense of oneness and unity with the universe, which some people listening to this may think is a bit hokey, but it was really, I guess that was what I'd been aiming for all of these weeks and months, but it took forgetting about it and letting it go for it to come. So that's, I guess, right. The paradox.
And it, the way you describe it is the way some religious people have described in religious texts experiences that they've had, and really makes me think that those are universal human experiences rather than tied to any particular religious scripture or practice. And along with all of that, there are other things that happen that are so funny that here I am, a reader, just laughing out loud, like the time that you were getting near to land and a pirate ship came and tried to pirate you guys. What happened?
I'm into spiritual matters, but I also think you can't take yourself too seriously. So I try to write the book pretty much how it was, and this particular experience that you describe, we were being blown onto the north coast of Cuba. We were about a week and a half out from Miami, and by this point we hadn't worn any clothes for months. There was no need to wear clothes out there because clothes they get wet, they get salty, they create chafing, and most of our clothes had washed overboard anyway over the course of the crossing. So we were both completely naked, and it was nice and warm. And anyway, this mystery boat came towards us on the north coast of Cuba, and it came alongside, and it was an unmarked motorboat, and there were these characters on board that were carrying semi-automatic weapons. And they weren't wearing uniforms, and we thought, "Uh-oh, this is bad. You know, we're going to get robbed here. You know, because they probably think we've got money or whatever. They're going to relieve us of our passports." And so, at this point, Steve had this enormous kind of ginger beard, and we were both looking like we had these 1,000-yard stares, and we both stood up in the boat together to speak to these guys who were yelling at us in Spanish. And I think the sight of us both in our birthday suits, the skipper who was like shouting at us, just their jaws dropped and nobody said a word. And they looked at us thinking, these guys are clearly insane in this tiny little boat, you know, butt naked. And they've obviously got some hideous diseases that we don't want to catch. And at that point, they just turned the boat around and they shot back to Cuba. And that was the last we saw of them.
We're talking to Jason Lewis about his book, The Expedition. There's another kind of funny moment where a boat tries to rescue you full of, I think, Filipino guys. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you said you didn't need rescuing, and they didn't understand until they found out that you were Englishmen.
Right, right. This was shortly after leaving Portugal, and yeah, I guess our little boat, it's so small that they must have thought we were in a life raft, that we'd been, you know, that we needed to be rescued from another ship that had sunk or something. So this was early in the morning, and this rescue boat comes alongside with these Filipinos, and they couldn't speak English at all. And we can speak Filipino, of course. So they started waving like, "Hey, we're going to rescue you, we're going to rescue you." And we were like waving back like, "No, it's fine. We're here. We want to be here. This is, you know, we're here by choice." And they thought they could not understand. And finally, the message sunk in that we were actually there by choice. And they said they went back to their container ship and like shaking their heads, thinking these guys are crazy. And when they got back to their ship, the skipper came on the radio and he said, "Oh, just want to make sure you guys want to be there for sure." You know, he's like, "Yeah, we're fine. So you don't need rescuing?" I'm like, "No, we're fine. We don't need rescuing." And he says, "Oh," and the skipper says, "One last question: which nationality are you from?" And we're like, "We're English." And he said, "Ah, okay, now I'm understanding." So I guess Englishmen have a reputation for doing these daft kind of things.
Well, it does remind you of the phrase mad dogs in Englishmen.
Right, right, exactly.
But you had, from early on, a Scottish cameraman named Kenny who was filming you and I guess getting ready to make a documentary. How did that go? Or is there going to be, or is there a documentary of this whole crazy circumnavigation of the Earth?
Yeah, actually, he sold 4 1-hours to Discovery several years ago now. They've I think it's ceased. Unfortunately, the licensing now has kind of ended. But he's just also finished a 2-hour edit for theatrical release, and he's hoping to get that out on the adventure film circuit. So, but I think he's looking for distribution. If anyone out there wants to distribute the Expedition film, then please get in touch.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something that we would like to see. And of course, you guys had to do the camera work when you were in the boat.
Right. I mean, so that was actually difficult. I mean, it's funny because the best, unfortunately, the most watchable material normally is when things go wrong. You know, I mean, and 90% of the time, nothing goes wrong, and that's not really the most interesting stuff. So we actually took a supreme sort of effort of will to, when things went wrong or we had a ship coming towards us that looked like it was going to run us down, that the trick was to try and sort of pick up the camera and film those things happening because we knew they would make the most interesting material. But the issue is, at some point, you're going to have to put the camera down, you know, when the boat's coming towards you with a bunch of pirates on it, or what, you know, some guys with semi-automatics. At some point, where do you stop filming
and start saving yourself?
Because A, they're going to steal the camera, for one, if they see the camera, and B, you got to deal with the situation at hand. So, and that's, I guess, one of the issues of filming yourself rather than having someone else come along like a camera crew.
Jason Lewis is author of the trilogy, The Expedition, The True Story of the First Human-Powered Circumnavigation of the Earth. The first book, which we've been talking about, is called Dark Waters. The others are going to be coming out, and you will be at Collected Works Bookstore this Saturday, the 17th of November at 6 in the evening, talking about your work and signing the book. And we really look forward to having you here. It's a wonderful, very readable, beautifully written book. How long did it take you to write the book? Was that something you did? It seems like you did it years afterwards. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, the writing of the book was almost another kind of expedition in itself. And I say that because when I finished the thing, I mean, it took me 13 years to circumnavigate the world by human power. But when I finished, there was a fair amount of coverage. And I was offered a lot of money by a big-name publisher for the rights for them to publish the book. But they wanted a ghostwriter to do it. And I thought, well, that maybe is going to work out, because there was such a huge amount of material in terms of handwritten journals and documentary footage. And I thought it would be easier to edit the stuff down. But anyway, but they wanted it quickly in 10 weeks as a crash book for the Christmas market. And when I read what this guy had written, some of the draft chapters, it was just unreadable. It was terrible, substandard stuff. And so I was left with a choice. Do I take the money and let them put out this trash, or do I write the story myself and do right by the integrity of the journey? And that's what I ultimately ended up doing. But it was a long process, and I've, you know, been pretty broke since the end of the trip, so I've needed to find other work to keep on writing the book. But in a way, I almost think now, having finished the three books, that the journey itself prepared me for the writing of it, because both, you know, pedaling across an ocean is like writing a book. They're both incredibly tedious, boring, and at times you feel like just giving up. But if you can just find a way to keep going, find a way to keep writing, or find a way to keep pedaling, then you do get there in the end.
Well, we're very glad you did. Jason Lewis, thank you so much for joining us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'm very happy right now to welcome Thomas Yen. He is curator of the exhibit Tall Tales of the Wild West, The Stories of Carl May, which opens this Sunday at the New Mexico History Museum and runs through the 9th of February, not next year, but the year after, 2014.
Welcome. Yes, it is.
Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So who was Carl May? He's somebody virtually unknown here and so well known in Germany.
Not only in Germany, but also all over Europe. And he was a writer who wrote about the Wild West. He wrote about what then was called the Orient. We call now Near Asia or Asia Minor. And he was just fascinated with these exotic lands. He never visited, obviously, but when you look at his library, he knew everything about those countries. He had all the important books, he had all the important anthropological studies, and then he tweaked it a little for making more sense for his stories.
It's so interesting that he was so fascinated by these places that he'd never been, particularly the Old West. I mean, can you tell from having studied him so much where that came from?
This is generally, Germans are interested in Native Americans and the American West. When you consider in 19th century, late 19th century, nobody really could travel to the United States unless you had money and you had 6 weeks for a ship. So they read, and they read about it. And then there is Alexander von Humboldt, who was interested about it and wrote academically about it. It is just, was and still is today, a fascination to Europeans. Tony Hillerman is two books with which I end my show. He's translated into German, into French. People know Tony Hillerman, and they read about the Navajos.
Right, right. And I guess I always thought that the reason they were so interested was because of Karl May. They were interested before that.
They were interested before then, yeah. And Karl May is, in many ways, he wrote adventure stories. And they were fascinating, like my kids today, now I forget the title, Harry Potter's today, what kids read.
Right.
Even though Karl May never thought, considered himself as a juvenile writer. He thought he was writing for adults with one or the other book for kids, but by and large, it was kids and young teenagers who read his books.
I have to tell you, my mother, who grew up in Germany, and in fact grew up in the same town mm-hmm. where Karl May lived, Radebeul, mm-hmm. Would get his books for Christmas, but then she wouldn't be able to read them till January because her father would take them.
This is about the only category I can put myself with Albert Schweitzer and Albert Einstein. We all read Karl May under the cover so that our parents wouldn't find out we're still reading them. The writing is not that exciting anymore for today's kids. But whether they read Karl May or read Karl May, they still know who Winnetou is, and they know Old Shatterhand, and they may not have read it, but they have a concept of who those people were. While for most Europeans it is just the Wild West, it is interesting for us here in New Mexico because Karl May put his hero south of Roswell along the Pecos. He picked the Apaches. It is not quite clear why, but then he also puts them into a pueblo rather having them nomadic. I know he had reasons for it, but I do know that he knew they were not pueblos. It is just for his writing.
Artistic license.
He needed to have them sedentary.
In his books, in his adventures, and some of the same characters come up over and over again, are the Indians always the good guys and the cowboys the bad guys, or is it mixed? Or
it is to some extent mixed. Obviously, the Apaches are his heroes. The Comanches are not, but the bad guys are usually the Americans, the Yankees, and never the Germans.
Are there Germans in the books?
Old Shatterhand is German.
Ah, okay.
He's a German engineer who worked for the railroad initially in these books. And he becomes what they call a Blutsbruder, a blood brother, to Winnetou. And Karl May liked the Native Americans. And he blames the Anglo-Americans, the Yankees, for dooming Native American races.
Now, why did he never actually go to New Mexico, go to the West?
Well, first of all, he started writing when he was 32, 33, 34. He spent several years in heavy prison for stealing, for impersonating. He had an affair, apparently. All things that you would today not get very much prison time for, but at the time he did. And it was then when he came out of prison the last time, in, like I say, when he was 32 or 3, that's when he started to write. But he was poor. He had no money. So he went to the United States, or he went, the other segment of his writing is, as I said, the Orient or the Asia Minor. He spent a year in Turkey, in Africa, in Egypt, and Persia at the time. He went all through that to visit what he wrote 10, 20 years earlier, because then he had money.
Right.
And then he stayed in the finest hotels. He did not go into those tents. And that part of the attraction or part of the fun is that initially he made the readers believe he was Old Shatterhand. He was Kara Benemsi. These adventures, he experienced them all. He made the readers believe that he actually was in all these places. Supposedly, no, not supposedly, he tells his readers he knows 20, 30 languages and dialects. And if he knew rudimentary English, it was a lot. He knew none of them. And that all came out piece by piece, some during his lifetime, some after his death. And it just makes it a fascinating story. And he is still, to some extent, revered. To some extent, they hate them over there, probably. But it is just fascinating.
Now, Karl May was born, we're talking about the upcoming exhibit that actually opens this weekend called Tall Tales of the Wild West, the Stories of Karl May. He was born in, what, 1842?
1840s, yeah.
And so he was doing this work in the 19th century when Indian lands were certainly in a period of tremendous change. Was the news coming to him? I mean, was he focusing at all on current events and things like that?
He did some current events, but he knew James Fenimore Cooper. Again, he knew what Humboldt wrote. He had various books of German authors who'd been to the United States. Duden, Gerstecker, they all write about what they thought was the West. For some of it was Arkansas, but it doesn't matter. And so he had scientific, he had the Wheeler survey maps, scientific mapping projects from the federal government here. He knew all that. And so it was just then spinning the stories around it. And the stories are probably not different than any other writer like Louis L'Amour or Zane Grey. It's just that he made his readers believe he actually did this. And when they look at him, he made it to New York once. Upstate New York, that is.
Now, when you say they're no different from Louis L'Amour and Zane Grey, things like that, is that really true? I mean, if you were to read an English translation of Karl May, and you were to read these others, one wouldn't have like a German feel about
yes,
it.
Yes, one does. In that sense, it's not true. But it is probably one reason why Karl May is not necessarily popular or known in the U.S. because we did have Zane Grey or American writers. The Americans had the opportunity to go to Santa Fe that Europeans didn't have. So no, it has heavy German overtone. Winnetou came to Dresden to visit Karl May, even though Winnetou doesn't exist, but he had him come. Winnetou spoke German. The Navajo chief was married to a German woman. There was a overtone at the end of the 19th, early 20th century of the Germanic, Teutonic greatness. And considering that Germany started in 1871, there was no Germany before, it just started to get a reputation or a recognition as a country before they started the build up to World War One. Then it gets down the drain again.
But right.
If you take out all the Germanic part, it is a Wild West story. It is the Native Americans are pushed back because the railroad is coming. It is pushed back because there is some bad guy who wants the Native Americans or the Apaches gold. It's a story like you read very often.
Right.
And again, there is a Germanic overtone in it. That's why some academicians also think that's why Hitler liked his writing. It's too complicated for me. I'm not going into this. But Hitler did read Karl May. He had his novel sitting there. But so did Albert Einstein. So did Albert
Schweitzer. So did everybody.
So this by itself.
I mean,
itself,
so did my relatives.
There you go. Yeah, so this is really not a sign for it. But there is academic literature of how Hitler may have been influenced in his speeches by some of Karl May's. And he was very philosophical, not brilliant, I would say, but he tried to be humanistic, peace. Native Americans have to be saved from the Anglo-American. Some of it was a little quirky, but he is dead 100 years, and most people still recognize the name, even if they don't read him necessarily anymore. And some of the recognition and some of the fame is also the movies that came out in the 1960s.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. So these stories, and there are many of them, some of them were made into movies.
Some of them were made into movies, and some of them really have nothing in common with Karl May's stories. They just took the title and was high production, was done in 1963, sort of a precursor to the Italo spaghetti western.
Right.
And Lex Barker was Old Shatterhand, and Lex Barker played before Tarzan. They needed a replacement for Johnny Weissmuller. They picked Lex Barker, and that gave him some fame, but he is better was better known in Europe than he was here, because he did a lot of his movies in Italy, in Spain, and Germany.
So like the Karl May novels, these were kind of fantasies about the Wild West that played in Europe and probably never got to the United States.
I don't understand.
Did we see them here?
Oh, yes. First of all, and again, it's the kind of funny aspect to it is Yugoslavia at the time replaced New Mexico. That's where they filmed them. Today, since the countries are split, it is Croatia, a national park there. The Pecos itself cannot hold. It's not the same, but the landscape, the scenery, it could hold for New Mexico. It's really interesting. Wide open space, very granite kind of rocks there and mountains, so it can hold up for it. Not the Pecos, like I say, that's a little different, but they were seen all over the world. They were all dubbed. There's about 15 countries that I found that show it. The American version was called Apache Gold. The interesting part is I went to Sony Columbia Pictures. They have it in their database, but they have no copy of it.
Really?
No copy of it. And so I got a copy that I bought on Amazon, and on the cover on the back, the blurbs are in Swedish, Finnish, and Danish. And when I opened it, I couldn't play it because it had a European country code on it.
Right.
So that had to go out first. Then the color system was different, so that had to go out, which Sony or Columbia would usually never let you do, but they had no copy. So it is kind of strange because this Apache Gold version is halfway dubbed. They leave some German in when they think it's not worth translating. They only translate the highlight. I'm not exactly sure if what the copy that I have is actually Apache Gold, because the lead-in says Winnetou. And I would suspect if you show it in the US or in any other country, you use the native title, Apache Gold, or whatever the Spanish called it, or the Portuguese.
Right.
But that's all we have.
Now, are you showing any of the films during this exhibition?
We show the film per se, we show on Friday, November 30th, once in its entirety, and I have a gentleman, Kirk Ellis, who will introduce the film. But we also got the rights, we pulled out about 10 minutes of clips that will be showing continuously between 11 and 3 per day in the auditorium as part of the exhibit.
Nice.
And so we cut a little bit out where it says Roswell, we cut a little bit out where the Apache's Pueblo, which is only a front, they didn't really build it, but they built a front for it, which shows, and just to get a taste of what Europeans or Germans saw as the West at the time. And again, it's sometimes awkward, it's 1963, but
we're talking to Thomas Jehn, curator of the exhibit Tall Tales of the Wild West, The Stories of Karl May. So what is in the actual exhibit?
The actual exhibit has primarily books, photos, some maps, an atlas, and is basically showing the bibliographical history of Karl May. The only item that we really borrowed from the Karl May Museum in Radebeul is Winnetou's Silberbüchse, silver rifle, whatever it's translated to. That will be coming over from Germany, we hope, this Thursday. And the curator in Germany and I, we both are very excited because we thought mythically how great it is that a rifle that actually was supposed to have functioned in New Mexico will actually see New Mexico. I have to go one step back here. Karl May made his readers believe that he went to Wyoming where Winnetou died and went to Winnetou's grave, dug it up, took the rifle out so that Winnetou could be at peace. And the rifle is ever since on display in Germany, in the Karl May Museum. It turned out that the rifle never shot. It was a prop. It was made in Germany. So it was just that, a prop.
Well, I mean, it sounds like he was trying to really make his readers believe that his characters existed in real life.
Absolutely. He tried that. And that the characters existed is one thing, but that he is one of the characters is on top of it. And that's where one can make either fun of him or fault him for.
Now, he's so well known in Germany but you were saying that the younger generation may not be as into him as, mm-hmm. as their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. Yeah. Is he in danger of being forgotten?
Absolutely not. Like I say, if it makes the New Yorker, that's already a sign that he's not quite forgotten. There are German Indian clubs over there that keep his memory alive. There is an annual Festspiel or festival in Bad Segeberg, which has a quarry as their stage. And they play Karl May plays every year. And I don't know if you... It's the same setup. Farmington has a quarry where they do Wild West shows during the summer. I've been to that one. It's the same setup. It's just different shows that they are doing. So he won't... Like I say, I've been to Germany in November. I opened 3 newspapers. One kid is quoted as saying, "I want to be like Winnetou." The kid was maybe 7. I'm not sure he read it, but he knew what Winnetou was like. There was a rerun of Winnetou Part 1 on TV in another newspaper. And then I saw another one. I mean, the name pops up. It is there. And some of the academicians, there's also a Karl May Society that makes sure nobody will forget. And while some do not take him very serious, others want him in the school curriculum as reading material. Hasn't happened yet, but
right.
some push for it. And he wrote over 100 volumes. And considering that he started when he was 33 or 34, mathematically they figured out he had to have written 4 pages a day.
Every single day.
And this is phenomenal. Some of the novels that he wrote were never published until after his death.
So there's no danger of his being forgotten in Germany anytime in the near future, but there is a possibility of his becoming known in the United States. Are his books readable here in translation?
When I started looking for it, I could find only 3 or 4 translations. One was from 1890, that was bootlegged and probably illegal, and the person who translated changed old Shatterhand's name to something else, and it was called For Our Boys and Girls, Based on Karl May. So they did their own tweak in 1890.
Right.
I have that book on display. And then the next translation that I'm aware of was in 1973 or 74. Since then, there are considerable translations of all his books, or many of his books, so it is available. And I just had lunch with a colleague. He showed it to me on his Kindle, so you can't bring him down.
So it's out there.
Yeah.
The exhibition opens this Sunday. It's called Tall Tales of the Wild West, The Stories of Karl May. And this Sunday at 2 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum, we will have a guest curator, Hans Grunert, who is from the Karl May Museum in Radebeul, Germany. And then there will be a series of lectures and films and all sorts of things coming up. And so we will see you at 2 o'clock this Sunday at the New Mexico History Museum. Tomás Yane is the curator of this exhibit. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.